If you're listening to this, then you likely already know that being an independent musician can be a lonely road. And maybe your friends and your family just don't fully understand why you do what you do or why you invest so much time, energy, and money towards achieving your music goals. And especially early on, it can be hard to find people who really understand what you're trying to accomplish and how to make it happen. So that's where Modern Musician comes in. My name is Michael Walker, and you know, I can understand and relate to that feeling. I've been there myself, and so has our team of independent artists. And the truth is that basically everything good in my life has been the result of music. It's the reason I met my wife. It's why I have my three kids. It's how I met my best friends. And now with Modern Musician, we've seen so many talented artists who started out with a dream, with a passion, but without really a fan base, without a business, and be able to take that and turn it into a sustainable full-time career and be able to impact hundreds of thousands, even millions of fans with their music. And we've had thousands of messages from artists who've told us that we've helped change their lives forever. And it just gets even more exciting, fulfilling when you're surrounded by a community of other people who get it and who share their success and their knowledge with each other openly. And so if you are feeling called to make your music a full-time career and to be able to reach more people with your music, then I want to invite you to join our community so that we can support your growth and help lift you up as you pursue your musical dreams. You'll be able to interact in a community with other high-level artists, coaches, and industry professionals, as well as be able to participate in our daily live podcasts, meet these amazing guests, and get access to completely free training. If you'd like to join our family of artists who truly care about your success, then click on the link in the show notes and sign up now.
So ASCAP is not for profit, which is not a nonprofit. Nonprofit means that nobody in the company can basically be paid. They have to do the service. They have to volunteer. So like, you know, homeless shelters are nonprofits that people volunteer their time to, or food banks, things like that.
Welcome to the Modern Musician Podcast, where each week I help you turn your passion for making music into a profitable career. This is all about you discovering and expressing who you really are so that you can build a loyal fan base that truly resonates with you and with your music. You can impact more people with your artwork. I'm your host, Michael Walker, and let's get into it. All right, I'm excited to be here today with my new friend, Caleb Shreve. Caleb is the founder and CEO of Killphonics Rights. They offer comprehensive rights management services to indie artists and labels. He's a veteran music producer and engineer. He's worked with Fanagram, Tegan and Sarah, and Switchfoot, among many others. And he's an advocate for artist empowerment, focused on transparent royalty collection and educating artists about their rights. And so, Caleb, I really appreciate you taking the time to hop on the podcast today and share a little bit about your perspective coming from the music industry and working deeply within the music industry as an artist and an engineer yourself, to now having this company that helps artists get connected about their rights and manage their finances in a more transparent way. So thank you for being here today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to talk about all this.
Absolutely. So yeah, maybe to kick things off, I would love to hear just a little bit more about your story of how you got started and eventually came to start Killphonics.
Yeah. So I was, a musician and played in bands all through high school and through my teen years. Right after high school, I had actually gotten like a development deal, which is something that doesn't really happen anymore. This is like the late 90s. And that development deal included us getting, a producer and a studio to record a record for the band I was in at the time. The record was a tragic failure, I guess I'd say. It just did not come out well. And I remember kind of at that point telling myself, like, I just never really connected with the producers on it. And, telling myself that I'd probably have to go figure out how to produce records myself. That's what I wanted to do. So, I got a job at Sony. I was actually an intern at Sony while I was still in high school. Left, popped around a couple of other studios in New York City, and then went back to Sony in like 1998, and kind of worked my way up to being an engineer. And I got on the special products team, which is all of Sony's bigger artists. So, I was working with Jennifer Lopez and Mark Anthony and Michael Jackson and Destiny's Child almost every day. On different sessions as an engineer. I moved on from Sony, was a freelance engineer for a while, and then started producing in New York. And this was probably around the time that Brooklyn was really becoming the big thing, nationally. you know, bands like MGMT and stuff and LCD Sound System were coming out of Brooklyn. So I kind of latched onto that scene and produced a bunch of indie rock bands. That's when I met Phanagram, and another band I was in went on tour with Tegan and Sarah. That's how I met them. And so I did a lot of touring, obviously did a lot of records in the studio, worked for major and indie labels for, you know, a couple of decades, signed my own publishing deal with BMG as a songwriter. So when I moved to LA, I thought that this is 2015 then. You know, I kind of was starting to want to get out of the studio, and I knew because of all my experiences that I probably would be a fairly good manager for young artists. Started managing a few artists, found that I didn't really like management too much, honestly. I just, it's a lot of more interpersonal relationships to deal with in management. And, you know, I wanted to focus on the business. And I saw that most of my management clients, or all of my managed clients, really didn't have many good options for publishing. And like I said, I had been through the co-publishing system with BMG, and I didn't necessarily like the idea of selling rights at such an early phase of an artist's career, but knew that publishing was important to collect. It was an important revenue stream. So I started to help my management clients, you know, go after international royalties that weren't necessarily accessible to them. I got on the competing board to become the MLC with Jeff Price, and we ended up losing that bid to the board of the MLC now. And after that happened, I really kind of made a solid commitment to get rid of my management client, or not get rid of them, but I kind of let my management clients fall to the side. And I started building the publishing company that I had always wanted to be accessible to them when I was managing them. So that was really the birth of Kilphonic Rights and the start of the publishing endeavor I went on. And like I said, that kind of turned me into an expert in rights and royalties and intellectual property. And, you know, I found that most artists that I came across, and a lot of people, you know, even at labels and other publishers, didn't really understand where these rights were, how they were collected, and what their, you know, what their rights to them were. So yeah, I've started educating. I speak a lot on panels and podcasts and stuff to try and, you know, educate as many people as I can, because I do think there's a lot of money out there that is ultimately falls into these black boxes around the world and gets distributed to the majors. And that just never sat right with me. I thought that the majors made plenty of money and those artists made plenty of money, and I really wanted to kind of funnel the money that was owed back to independence to the people that deserve that money. So that's what I do now.
Awesome. Cool. Thanks for sharing. I mean, it sounds like you've had quite the journey, you know, in your music life, and now you're able to, you know, help artists who are maybe at an earlier phase, who don't have access to kind of resources that they really need in order to understand kind of a complicated map of what is royalties and collection. So maybe for anyone who is listening to this and they are kind of familiar with the landscape, at least like a little bit, but they're not totally, maybe they're like a little bit confused about how does royalty collection work, you know, for indie artists. And when you say black box, could you share a little bit more about what that black box is and how it works, and you know, maybe some of the most common questions that you see artists when they first come to you about this topic?
Yeah. So I'll start from the beginning. I know that I tend to get very deep in the weeds very quickly, but to start, for anybody who doesn't know the basics of it, it's actually fairly simple in my mind. Again, this is my mind and I've been doing this for years, but there are two copyrights that are associated with music. There is the composition, which is the words and music, and the songwriting that is the underlying song that exists on the second copyright, which is sound recording. So people also call that the master. So there is your copyright that's associated with writing a song with other people. And then there's more of a physical copyright to the sound recording or master that's created from that song. Each of those copyrights then have two usages. And this is for royalties specifically. A lot of people I've been in conversations, especially with like professors and things at colleges that are trying to get this straight for their students. There are other ways to license your music, like sync and things like that, but this is the royalties that are associated with music. And there's only two real usages. There is the public performance of both of those copyrights, and there's the reproduction of both of those copyrights. So on the most common thing that people know about in publishing is ASCAP or BMI. They collect the public performance or broadcast of your songwriting. So that's any time that it's kind of a one to many situation where, you know, your song is performed on the television show, or it's performed on the radio, or even performing it live in a venue to a lot of people. There is a public performance royalty that is paid out to the songwriter for that usage. And then on the other side of reproduction, there's the mechanical royalties that are paid for publishing. So the mechanicals are every time your song is reproduced. It was traditional for years that the label was responsible for paying mechanical royalties when they would produce your CD or tape or vinyl record or whatever kind of physical medium used to exist. When digital streaming came out, for one, it became that money was often prepaid before the sale of the vinyl. So as the production happened, they would pay the songwriters for the rights to reproduce their composition. But when streaming came along, you know, you couldn't really predict how many streams you think we're going to get. So, and the copy actually happens from, you know, Spotify server to your phone. So the label's kind of out of the loop in that. So the onus of paying mechanical royalties flipped to the DSPs when digital streaming came out. I can get into that later, but that's why the MLC was created in the more recent years. On the sound recording side, though, there is also a reproduction royalty for the master, which is your streaming royalties. They're called artist royalties. They're basically the kind of traditional selling or streaming or any kind of, you know, that's the money you get from DistroKid or you would get from selling a vinyl. Those are royalties that are paid for the reproduction and sale of your masters. And then the public performance of your masters are a kind of a royalty that a lot of people don't understand too much, but those are neighboring rights. If somebody asks you what neighboring rights are, it is the public performance of the sound recording. And each of these four pieces of the pie are also subdivided. So on the performance side of publishing, it's half is paid to the publishers and half is paid directly to the songwriters. And there's kind of an equivalent split on neighboring rights as well. Half of the money for neighboring rights is paid to the master rights holder, which is the label or the person who owns the sound recording. And then half of the money, I mean, in the US, it's 45% goes to the featured artists on the record, which are the artists that are in the band. If it's a three-person band, it's split three ways or however the band decides they want to split it. But 45% is paid to the featured artists. And there's a little 5% sliver that's paid to the background artists, which goes through the union in the US. So like I said, then, you know, on the mechanical side, there's splits as well. But those are the four main royalties you need to look at. Which I said, it's why it's kind of simple if you can understand that. The ways to collect these royalties and where they are is a lot more complicated. I mean, especially the US. When I started Kilphonic, I had the idea of helping artists in the U.S. collect their international royalties, but I found that actually there's so many international clients that really need help in the U.S. because we have five PROs here now. We have ASCAP, BMI, CSAC, GMR, and AllTrack, which is a lot for a single country to have five PROs. I think Brazil has seven, but, you know, most places have one. And then we have obviously the MLC here, but mechanical societies are not reciprocal like performance societies are. So, you know, ASCAP can go to the UK to PRS and get your royalties there and do reciprocal agreements, but the MLC does not go to MCPS and get your mechanical royalties. So you really need a publishing administrator as well to get all of your royalties around the world. But back to the US, there's also, we have another split of mechanicals, which you pay for what we call microsync. That's YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, things where it's consumed like a stream, but it's associated with a moving picture, so it becomes a sync royalty. Those generally in the US are collected or licensed through a company called Music Reports. So it's another society. Kilphonic has a direct deal with YouTube, but most, if you are not associated with a publisher or publishing administrator in the US, you would need to collect from your PRO, the MLC, and from Music Reports to kind of get the most of your royalties. And then to your question about black box royalties, it's, you know, especially YouTube is one of them, but the MLC is more like known for having a black box of money. So that's what happened really was when streaming started in 2012 in the US and companies like TuneCore started, they were uploading tons of music to these platforms, but Spotify wasn't requiring the publishing information in the beginning. So you would upload all these songs and, you know, the publishers and their songwriters were unknown. Spotify knew they had to pay these mechanical royalties, but they didn't actually have the data or information to know who they had to pay. So they just held on to that money and they called it, you know, that's called a black box in music royalties. So it's this money that's unknown who owns it that sits in a big account somewhere. So they decided in 2018 to start the Music Modernization Act to modernize some of our laws and rules. And in that act, they created the MLC, which was, you know, run by the U.S. Copyright Office and was designated to a group of individuals that could apply to become the board of the MLC and run the MLC. And it was that on them to distribute that black box by trying to educate the you know, market about what the MLC was, educate artists about that, and then have them sign up and register their songs and then get paid the mechanical royalties or in the black box. And there was about $440 million in the black box when the MLC started. The MLC has not been doing a great job at finding those people. So that black box has actually increased. And some people think it's up to close to $1 billion now. It was, they had,
you know, I was looking at my books the other day and it did seem like I was missing about $1 billion from my music stream. So if they're looking for like the person that they were supposed to send that to, I think that, it looked like I was actually missing about that amount if they wanted to shoot it away. I think they said
it was mostly your money. So, I'll have that over to you. I mean, it was like some tax audits and stuff that a few publications had done that had found that they were, you know, basically claiming their taxes that they had this big tranche of money that was exceeding the $440 million that was originally there. So, yeah, that box is actually getting bigger. And the way they do with black box money is eventually they hold on to it for generally. I mean, PROs do this too. You know, if you have a song, say internationally, which is another reason why it's important to have an administrator, but if you have a song, say in Germany, that has the same title as the song here, or your song is written here, but has the same title of another song in Germany, ASCAP and BMI have reciprocal agreements, but they don't really sort conflicts out. So if they get a, you know, like I said, a tranche of conflict back from GAMO, which is the PRO in Germany, you know, ASCAP's not going to go through and try to fix those conflicts, you know. So a publishing administrator like us, we go direct to every PRO so that we have access to all of their databases. And when we see conflicts in their portals and their systems, we resolve those conflicts. We actually get file back called an ACK file, which is an acknowledgement of our registrations that tells us when there's conflicts and problems and missing data and stuff like that. So anyway, again, like if you're just going through ASCAP or BMI and you have a song that's in conflict in their territory, the money sits there until, you know, for 3 to 5 years as well. And they distribute it to their members, you know, after that black box is distributed. So all PROs and YouTube and the MLC all have these like black boxes of money that they generally hold for a couple of years to try and resolve. And then if they can't, then they distribute it to their market by their market share.
Got it. Yeah. So it sounds like what you're saying is that, you know, first they put it in this box that's sort of like unknown who this belongs to. And then after a certain amount of time, they will distribute it, but just kind of guess based on the average percentage that they're already paying out. And I mean, to me, like when I've heard that before, and I think you were alluding to this earlier as well, is that unless there's something I'm missing, it seems like that system would disproportionately affect indie artists because you know, most major record label artists aren't making the mistake of not declaring like, you know, they're publishing.
100%. I mean, that was why we had such a brutal fight over the MLC was that... What happened to me was I knew that this was because before the MLC, there still is a company called Harry Fox Agency. Harry Fox Agency kind of worked for a long time for the DSPs and the publishers to kind of match that money. So major publishers were getting these mechanical royalties out of Spotify through their own registrations from 2012 on. All of the black box money, that $440 million, was independence money. It was not majors. Those artists, that, like I said, and you said, have been getting paid because they understand the royalty landscape much better. So when I found out the MLC board was coming up, I looked at who was proposed on the other side, and it was all major label executives, and I was confused why.
That's what I did. No conflict of interest here.
Yeah. So that's when I reached out to a friend of mine, and he said, yes, it's a huge conflict of interest. And that's why Jeff Price is starting another competing board to try and become the MLC. And he put me in touch with Jeff, and that's how that all started. So, yeah, that's a huge conflict of interest. And, you know, seemingly, because again, like at the end, in 3 years or 5 years, whatever, they decide to empty that black box. It was statutorily only 1 year, but they've extended it because of COVID and things like that. So, but at some point soon, I think at the top of next year, probably, I was assuming the top of this year, they were going to distribute it, but very soon they're going to say, hey, we couldn't find these people and we're going to distribute the money. So it's not really even like guessing, like you said, like to who it belongs to. It's straight up just goes by market share. So if you have the biggest market, which is, I guess, Sony right now, and then Universal, they kind of compete for the top spot in publishing. They're going to get the majority of that money, and none of it is theirs. It's just money that belongs to independents that couldn't register, couldn't find the mechanicals before the distribution happened.
Mm. Wild. Man, well, it makes me grateful that there's people like yourself and companies like yourself that are trying to help, you know, educate independent artists on how to receive, you know, some of this money that they're just like, they're just owed. It's their money.
It's there's too few of us, to be honest, though. I mean, I've run into very few people that take this kind of cause on. I think that publishing is not quite as valuable as the master overall, but it's still a very valuable resource and revenue stream. So yeah, I wish more people would take it seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, especially for indies, it feels like probably every dollar counts.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, whenever I talk with someone that's smarter than I am in this area, like yourself, I always start out and every time I hear this, like, I'm like starting to like understand the landscape better. I'm like, oh yeah. Like you're on like the Groot, like fundamentals. And then like at a certain point, my brain starts to be like, ooh, it's like when we're like, well, then this like breaks up in a different subcategory. And at some point, like in the conversation, I'm wondering myself, like, you know, is this the best way to handle this? Or is like, is this like the simplest way? Or is there a simpler or a better way? And obviously it's just like, you know, there's so many roots kind of that have been formed around the way that it is. So I'd be curious to hear your perspective as someone who literally like spends so much time figuring out the conflicts and the issues that exist right now. If you could wave a magic wand and just sort of like erase everything that exists right now in terms of how the structure is set up, and you're kind of looking at knowing in how, in hindsight, kind of how things have panned out, what do you think that it would look like in an ideal scenario if it was like you started from scratch and they like gave you a crown? They're like, all right, Caleb, like it's on you to kind of like, you kind of figure out a structure for this. What might that look like?
I mean, it's a really good question. And you know, I will say things that I think some people would absolutely disagree with, but it is, I don't think anybody would disagree that it is too convoluted and too opaque. It's funny, my thought, because I like in the beginning was like, oh yeah, this is very much purposeful to make this opaque so that major labels and other people can kind of cipher money out of the system. And then I kind of learned why all of these things took place. Like the songwriter royalty was basically, I mean, it was always just publishing up until the like late 60s, early 70s. But I believe it was in the 70s that they looked back and saw some like predatory agreements that have been made with, you know, a lot of like, you know, artists that maybe couldn't even like read, that were like signing X's on a contract just to, you know, get the label to put out their record, and not understanding they were signing away their publishing. So this kind of like songwriter royalty was a way to make up for those injustices, to say, you know, for those artists, and saying, hey, like, you know, publishing was misunderstood for many years. A lot of artists signed away their publishing without knowing what it was. So we're going to create a second royalty that's paid to writers. And that's why I ended up splitting the performance royalties between publisher and writer. That never happened on the mechanical side. So right there, that makes it really confusing, because, you know, ASCAP works on what they call 100% system. So 50% goes to the publisher and 50% goes to the songwriter. For years, actually, they both worked on a 200% system, which meant that if you owned 50% of a song, you got 50% of the publishing royalties and 50% of the songwriting royalties, and there would be a 200% pie in the performance royalties. But in the 100% system, basically what makes it confusing is that in your mechanical side, you're registering at 50-50, like if you and I write a song together. But on the performance side, you're registering at 25 and 25 on the publishing side and 25 and 25 on the songwriting side. So that kind of convolutes things. I feel like I would like to go back to maybe just a simpler world where it's like, you know, we don't have to subdivide the performance royalties and they can be quite equal to the mechanical royalties. Or I think do the opposite and make up songwriter royalty for the mechanicals, which doesn't exist right now. One of two things to kind of make those equitable. The biggest thing I think we should do, which I kind of fought for, I went to ASCAP's offices in New York during the MLC debate and said, basically, why are we starting another society? You know, in around the rest of the world, they've got what they call CMOs, which are collective management organizations. MCPS and PRS are, you know, sister companies in the UK that, you know, handle both the performance and mechanicals. I was like, why doesn't ASCAP take over the MLC and distribute the mechanical roads? You have all the streaming data, you have all the things you need, the infrastructure. Why build another company that people have to register with? And the answer was kind of like, we just don't do mechanical royalties, we do performance royalties. So I think, you know, and there is talk too about consolidating the five PROs we have here in the US. Like, is that necessary? So, you know, I mean, ASCAP is actually our only true PRO. They're the ones designated by CSAC, the kind of UN of all PROs, as our PRO in the US. BMI and CSAC and the others are called RMEs, rights management entities. So we really do only have one PRO, but we have five generally, you know, as
what's pragmatic. The way that those entities are set up, like, are they like a for-profit entity or like what's the, like, is there like competition, like market competition between them or like what's the compensation model for those companies? Yeah.
So ASCAP is not for profit, which is not a nonprofit. Nonprofit means that nobody in the company can basically be paid. They have to do the service. They have to volunteer. So, like, you know, homeless shelters are nonprofits that people volunteer their time to, or food banks, things like that. ASCAP is a not for profit, which is very different. It means that they, you know, the employees that work there and the CEO can get paid large compensation packages for their work. I mean, I believe the CEO of ASCAP makes, seven-figure salary and stuff like that. But they don't show a profit at the end of the year. BMI was not for profit for many years. They just recently, in the last couple of years, were bought out and turned into a for-profit company. CSAC is owned by BlackRock and is a for-profit company. Same thing with GMR and AllTrack. Those are all for-profit companies. And they do battle for market share, like you said. Like, there is definitely... One of the other problems we have because of that is that they've incentivized bigger songwriters, people like Max Martin and stuff, get larger royalties for the same usages that independents get because they've created these like super producer type credits. So if you reach certain thresholds, you get paid more money per stream and per radio play and per TV performance than an independent artist who doesn't cross those thresholds. And the reason was they were trying to, you know, garner those bigger producers to their side so that they had to negotiate a new contract with the radio conglomerates, for instance, they could prove they had a bigger market. And they kind of go back and forth. They kind of have a race to the bottom on how little they pay their independents and how much they can pay the top kind of upper echelon 1% so that they can get more of the market and then get bigger parts of these blanket licenses that they can enter into with the radio stations and the TV broadcasters and things like that. So yes, there is a fight for market share because then it ultimately ends up, like I said, larger parts of these blanket licenses. And they do that by offering incentives for bigger writers to come over to them and pay them more money. So yeah, the whole system is definitely broken. I mean, to go way to the other side of things, there's some people in the world who think that maybe copyright in general is not a great idea. I mean, it's really interesting now. I mean, I'll get a little like philosophical on the concept of copyright, but copyright was set up to create scarcity in the marketplace. That was the idea of it. So once things like printing presses and stuff like that were invented, they were like, oh, we can mass produce these, you know, like sheets of music and things like that. And the idea was that they wanted to incentivize people to still write music. So they created a copyright system to then have to license your work into, you know, pressing a certain number of sheets out of a printing press and fake and like artificially creating scarcity in the market. The problem now is that with Spotify and these other like newer technologies, there's no scarcity to music at all. You pay one subscription fee and you get access to everything. So we're trying to fit like this new model of consumption into an old model of copyright that hasn't been updated in like 100 years, really, conceptually. So in this new model, is copyright even valid? Is it the right system at all? Or should we all just be paid, you know, by these companies to buy our music for their platform and then move on from it without a royalty system? You know, I think a lot of people scoff at that idea really quickly, but ultimately what's working right now is not working. So it's two competing philosophies over what consumption of music looks like. Is it this unlimited idea where you pay one fee and then you get all the music in the world as much as you want? Or is it, you know, something where we need to go back and create scarcity and have copyright actually work for the rights holders? Cause it's just not doing that right now.
Really interesting. Yeah, I've thought a lot about that too, just in terms of the effect of like streaming, in terms of the market economics, and that like when you have unlimited supply of something, then like, you know, inherently the economic demand for it, you know, it goes down. And so what I'm hearing you say is that, you know, one interesting thing to consider is alternative model where these streaming services would actually pay upfront for the right to be able to stream unlimited, to give access to this unlimited streaming to their user base, mm-hmm. as one way to fix sort of this race to the bottom effect of like unlimited streaming, but paying out per royalties. Like, you know, because I mean, also it's like the amount of music is going up so much. We just don't have enough time to stream like, you know, all the different songs. So it does seem like there's something that needs to be fixed there.
I mean, there's other models too. I've always fought for the user-centric model, which is the idea that the money that you give goes to the things that you listen to. Because so if you paid $10 and listened to one artist 10 times, they'd get your $10. Because right now in this unlimited streaming thing, what happens is artists like Taylor Swift, for instance, their fan base is like mostly younger people who are maybe on like a family plan. So they're not even paying the full $9.99. Their subscription fee is probably something closer to $4.99. And they're over consuming. So their $4.99 is going into like hundreds of streams of one artist or a couple of big pop stars. So they're over consuming in their market. And then people who are paying $9.99, like older people like myself who, you know, work all day and come home and probably listen to very little music and have very little time for it, are under consuming. So our money is really going to pay artists like Taylor Swift for the overconsumption of their fans. And, you know, I'm like a Britpop fan from the 90s. So Blur and, you know, whatever, Pulp, things like that are not really making as much as my money, and I'm subscribing to Spotify so I can listen to those artists. They should get my money. So I've had people try and push back against why user-centric modeling doesn't work, but I've never really heard a good reason that I could, you know, basically I've just heard that they don't want to do it because it takes money away from the top artists and you need the support of Universal and Sony, because these companies own parts of Spotify. So the whole system is very rigged against independence in that way. And I haven't heard a good answer why user-centric modeling. There's one that is actually not good either, I'll tell you, is that some people argue that there's a lot of dead accounts on Spotify. So there is like, you know, people who pay for Spotify every month and like have forgotten about their accounts or like honestly passed away and their credit card's just still paying for an account and no one's using it. So where does that money go? But Spotify takes 30% of all revenue off the top. So I don't know why Spotify couldn't take all of their revenue of those dead accounts first, make up whatever money. I don't think 30% of Spotify's accounts are dead. That would be crazy. so they could take all of the debt account money and then just distribute all of the money for the accounts that are active. And, you know, again, that would solve that problem.
That's interesting. 30%. Pretty decent revenue cut from those. Yeah. I mean, I know Apple's been under fire somewhat recently with their 30% of the App Store commission. And I mean, they actually recently lost a case, right? So is that kind of in the air?
Over that, yeah.
So. Yeah. Okay. Really interesting. Yeah. As it relates to, scarcity and copyright and different models of music ownership or music assets, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on Web3 and music NFTs. Obviously, NFTs are sort of a big bubble pop, and there's a lot of, it's unregulated in many ways. So there's a lot of scam kind of stuff. So, there's sort of, it's a Wild West kind of there. But I've always felt music was an interesting place where it's actually, it kind of makes sense. But I'd be curious to hear your thoughts as someone who's an expert in this. How do you view some of these emerging markets, and specifically around digital collectibles and assets and the ownership there?
Yeah. I mean, I think tokenizing music in an NFT is interesting. Again, it creates a limited supply that becomes that scarcity thing comes back for it. And you know, anything that can kind of, to me, put the artist closer to the, to the consumer, without those people taking 30% along the way. I mean, that is better in my mind. I just, at this point, pragmatically, I don't think the system for NFT delivery and the functionality for it is simple enough that people will go there. So, I mean, it's always that argument of, how do you replace Spotify when it's so easy to pay $9.99? I mean, that was the idea of Spotify, was that people were file sharing, which is not much different, say, than kind of going on OpenSea and buying an NFT. It was just, you were pirating on Pirate Bay, but you had to have a program and, a protocol that would file share amongst a bunch of different people that were uploading. So, I mean, I remember those days in the early 2000s of Napster and Pirate Bay and things like that, where we'd download MP3s from file sharing services. But the average...
We got them, guys. All right, we can end the podcast now.
Okay. I'm just saying, I saw... myself. That just was so complicated for some people that when Spotify was like, how about this? You pay us $9.99, you get everything. People are like, great. And that's what resolved pirating of music, was this ease of operation or this ease of use. That so to try and replace that now with going back to kind of this NFT world where you have to get a wallet and you have to, buy the stuff on OpenSea and download to your wallet and find a player that you can attach your NFT wallet to. And I'm sure that would work for kids in their teen to, through their 30s. But, my parents are never going to get an NFT wallet to listen to music. So I don't know. It's interesting. I guess I'm trying to be a little more pragmatic and current about how to fix things. And I don't know if I see the future in it. I just don't know when we're going to get there to the point where it actually makes sense to be able to replace something as easy as Spotify. Cause that is the only argument that I can really go for streaming, is that it prevents pirating because it's so easy to use.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. What I'm hearing you say is that you think some of those territories are interesting and potentially something in the future that could work if they were simple enough and accessible enough so that people weren't more tempted to just illegally pirate things like we were in the past. So that's one thing that streaming has done really well, is make things accessible, easy to use in a way that's also somewhat regulated and at least paying out something to the owners. And maybe at some point in the future, when it's more pragmatic, there might be a way to cut out the middleman a little bit more and to reconnect artists with their fans.
I mean, I think that it kind of goes towards that user-centric modeling that I'm saying, is that you as a user are buying the NFTs that you listen to, and then having them in the wallet that you can stream as much as you want, but all of your money is going to the artist that you're listening to. So it just, like I said, it feels a little bit more like that user-centric model instead of this like pay per play kind of thing where, you know, people have inequities in what they pay to Spotify and, you know, and how much they consume. So yeah, I don't know. I can see it working in a way that is like I said, more profitable for independent artists and more fair, which is also a big barrier. That's like, you know, the biggest problem against user-centric modeling is that it takes money away from the top artists. So people like Universal and Spotify, I mean, Universal and Sony and Warner don't want to do it. So it needs the actual industry to jump on board.
Yeah, it's kind of hard when the people with the most sway or the most momentum, you know, like, don't want something to happen. Then, yeah, unless there's like equal influence in a different direction, it's kind of hard to move the momentum.
Yeah.
Okay. I think one thing that's interesting about the collectibles too is just like, on one hand, you know, you could imagine a platform where in order to stream the music or listen to it, like you also have to own the actual collectible. That feels like, I don't know if we'll ever go back there because, you know, the cat's out of the bag with streaming and digital, like down, like it's so easy to like, you know, for those things to get out that I kind of feel like that's, would be really hard to enforce. But then on the other hand, it seems like people are still, even if you can stream a song, like there is something about the status of like owning a limited collectible of something that inherently makes it more valuable, or at least have some kind of value.
Yeah.
I think of like the Mona Lisa, you know, for example, and you know, the, you can, you know, print out a copy of the Mona Lisa and kind of put it side by side in your house and hang it up and appreciate the art of it, you know, the same way you might appreciate like streaming a song. But if you put it side by side with the actual Mona Lisa, one's worth what, $800 million and one's worth like $10. I'm like, why is that? Like, you can appreciate it or listen to, you know, or see like both of them, but I guess arbitrarily, like people have kind of decided this is cool and this is one of a kind and we're willing to pay this much. But even like when you think of art in general, it's so subjective. Like some of the most famous artists, like they, their art had no value when they were alive and they died. And now, yeah, what a irony.
I mean, I do think music, yeah, music does to me fit the NFT model better than art. Like, I think that, you know, I know that, you know, like what is it? The apes, I forget the,
Bored Apes.
Bored Apes. Yes. Like when that became really popular and a big status symbol to have a, you know, a Bored Ape NFT, there was still this like, you know, cynicism that you're buying a JPEG, you know, like it's,
yeah,
what is a JPEG? Like a JPEG NFT is, you know, just a JPEG. And there was this idea of,
yeah, is this monkey really art? Yeah. Yeah, it's like, yeah,
but it was connecting the problem was connecting the actual artistic piece to the NFT. And in a visual medium, I guess is what I'm trying to say, is that it's a little bit harder, but sound recording as a copyright is a little bit of this amorphous kind of half physical digital thing anyway. So it does make more sense to me to connect a sound recording to an NFT because of the way we consume it. You know, it's not, we don't look at a song, we listen to it. So the actual NFT, I don't know, it just feels a little more connected to the art in that way for me. Makes it a little bit easier the idea of owning an NFT of a piece of music is a little bit easier to wrap my head around than owning an NFT of a JPEG that I have to like look at my computer. You know, like that's what I'm saying. Like music is once you have an NFT of music, you can play it through a stereo and it becomes the same thing as, you know, a CD or a stream. But a JPEG is like a file on your computer. It's not appreciated in the same way that a Mona Lisa is in the museum. You know, you could like print out your Bored Ape, but then it's not the NFT anymore. It's a physical print of it. So what is an NFT of a JPEG other than just this, like, you got to trust it's collectible. I mean, there's obviously like, you know, people were putting their Bored Apes on like their Instagram or Twitter, you know, profiles and verifying them there. But beyond that, yeah, there was like, it's not the same consumption that music is, where if you have these NFTs and you play them through stereo, you're consuming music the same as anything else and you own it.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, it's one thing, I don't know how much you know about Modern Musician or like Street Team, Caleb, but it's very new. But about a week and a half ago, we released a software as a service called Street Team. Mm-hmm. And the idea is to modernize the traditional concept of a street team, which is fans who support an artist so much that they hit the streets and, you know, promote them for free, but not usually for free. It was really in exchange for some kind of access or recognition from the artist, like a backstage pass or their community, you know, role. And so we wanted to modernize that and help and connect artists and their fans in a way that the artist owns the fan data, which right now, obviously, they don't, unlike Instagram or TikTok or Facebook. Someone else owns their audience. But this conversation, I think, is like really exciting to me, because next year, one thing that I really want to lean more into is, now that we have this community platform, helping artists to create digital assets around their songs and giving their fans utility, you know, access with their, what we're calling music relics, which is sort of like our version of NFTs, because we think NFTs is like a weird thing that no one's like, it's like, what the heck is a non-fungible token, right? Like a relic, like a music relic, you know, maybe understands a little bit better, like this is something like treasure to be like cherished. And yeah, so this is something that's a little bit of a precursor to that, but rarely I get to talk to someone that has the experience, kind of the perspective that you have around royalties and like, and understanding like the value of these assets and how you can, you know, license them and monetize them, to have a great perspective on where things are at and potentially innovative ways to be able to explore it. So really appreciate you taking the time, hop on the podcast and share some of your experience. And I'm grateful people like you exist to, you know, to have a voice for independent artists that don't necessarily always have that kind of backing. So thank you for being on the podcast, and for, you know, for anyone that is interested in connecting more or learning more about what you've built with Cophonics, could you share a little bit more about what the best place to be for them to get started?
Yeah, I mean, we obviously have Instagram and Facebook pages that you can go to. We don't necessarily, we've tried to do educational posts on there, but they're often not appreciated as much, I guess. So
it's a hard territory to, you know, like a lot of people, like they know it's important, but it's a lot to wrap their head around.
I mean, I honestly, the best place would, you know, if you Google podcasts, and me, I've spoken a lot of podcasts. If you go to some of the more traditional places like A2IM, the American Association of Independent Music, they've got a lot of resources. I did a webinar with them a month or two ago. You know, to go, I think that we as a company are associated with a lot of the more traditional outlets for education. So if you want to hear more from me, I'm speaking again on a panel at A2IM's conference this year in June. And I usually go to Music Biz as well, but I couldn't make it this year. But I think my educational outreach kind of goes through platforms like yours, where, you know, people who are talking about these things and have a bigger audience, I like to partner with them to get kind of the word out. So Google would be your best option there, or maybe I have, like, there's been some articles that I've either written or have been interviewed for that I think I've got links in my Instagram, my personal Instagram, there. So, you know, but yeah, I think to find us is Google us. I mean, you can reach out, you can DM us. I answer a lot of independent artist questions on Instagram when they DM me. So I'm able to get in touch. You know, you can contact me through the regular platforms, like I said, Instagram and such. But yeah, we don't have like a hub for education, unfortunately, because it's just never really, our company is a company that deals with royalties for artists. And, you know, I want to keep that main mission there for the people that work for me. We're not an education company, but, you know, these things do mean a lot to me and they're dear to me. So I speak again across other platforms that do more educational outreach.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, really appreciate it. And like always, we'll put the links in the show notes for easy access. Mm-hmm. And Caleb, look forward to talking again sometime soon.
Thank you for having me, Michael. It was great.
Hey, this is Michael, and I just wanted to say thank you for tuning in to this episode of the podcast. I hope you found it really valuable, and if you did, if you want to share the word, we really appreciate you leaving a 5-star review on the podcast channel. If you want to learn more about the guest, you can check out the show notes for the links. And before you go, I wanted to remind you that I'm looking for new artists to mentor personally. Before we get started, we always offer a free 30-minute coaching call to make sure it's a good fit before you get your campaign launched. At this point, the artists that we've worked with have hit over 561.3 million streams, a number one album on iTunes, and we've helped many artists grow from scratch to making a full-time income with their music online. In a few rare cases, they've even been able to generate $1 million per year with their music. That being said, we are very selective with who we work with, just based on who's the best fit and who we can best serve. And because we have a limited amount of time available for those free sessions, we do require an application process where you can submit your music and you can apply for a free coaching call with our team. So if you're interested, go ahead and click on the link in the show notes to submit an application, share one of your songs. We look forward to checking out your music, and we'll see you in the next episode.